is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get an updated perspective on the growing authoritarianism under the Trump administration.
Prominent professor and author of many books, Henry Giroux compares Trump's early moves to those of fascists of the past. Next, we hear from a journalist and author who describes the biased way the corporate media in America is covering the Trump administration and the Israeli-U.S. war in Gaza. Norman Solomon, author of War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, also critiques Trump's attacks on America's colleges and universities under the pretext that they have failed to adequately address anti-Semitism on their campuses.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National...
Welcome to Public Affairs here at WRCT Pittsburgh. As usual, we'll listen to the news clips of the week as chosen by Rick Adams and myself, Kevin Amos. So sit back and take a listen and get caught up.
Greetings, Lumination. Happy Friday. I am Monique Presley. Welcome again to The Week with Monique. This time and space on the Don Lemon channel where we pick that one thing. If we have to pick that one thing that you should pay attention to in the midst of all the news, all the noise, all the frankly mayhem that's going on in this country right now, here's the one thing that I'm asking you to highlight and pay attention to. If you don't know it, and if you can't tell by my blue, this month is Autism Awareness Acceptance Inclusion Month. This is the last official week, so the last Friday that I would have an opportunity to talk to you about that. And it's important every April and every other month of the year, certainly, but I am particularly wanting to highlight Autism Awareness Acceptance Inclusion this time because of statements, hideous, horrendous statements and planned actions that we're hearing about from the current administration and from the head of HHS. For those of you who don't know, autism is a neurological disorder that is marked by delay in speech and often marked by repetitive or idiopathic movements in younger children around the age of 2. Is the earliest that there can be an official diagnosis. Right now, 1 in 31 children in the United States have been diagnosed with autism. It disproportionately affects boys more than girls, and we see it disproportionately affecting Black and Brown communities more than their white counterparts. 1 in 45 adults in the United States have autism, and it obviously is something that deserves attention, that deserves adequate research, and the children who are on the spectrum and their families deserve the best services they possibly can have, as well as the promise of this nation, a free and appropriate public education for each child, whether you learn differently or not. So that is the promise. And we are watching this administration tear that down by trying to gut the Department of Education, by trying to take funds away that go from the federal government to the states that are used for special needs programs, that are used in order for children who are growing into young adults to have the best chance to strive, to learn how to work, to have proper paraeducators and services. But to make matters worse, this week, RFK Jr., the head of HHS, said this.
This is an individual tragedy as well. Autism destroys families. More importantly, it destroys our greatest resource, which are our children. These are children who should not be suffering like this. These are kids who, many of them, were fully functional and regressed because of some environmental exposure into autism when they're 2 years old. And these are kids who will never pay taxes, they'll never hold a job, They'll never play baseball. They'll never write a poem. They'll never go out on a date. Many of them will never use a toilet unassisted. And we have to recognize we are doing this to our children, and we need to put an end to it.
Now, we're in the middle of Autism Awareness Month, and this man, who seems to have quite literally autism on the brain, chooses those comments. It's not just that it was dark. It's not just that it was dire. It's not just that it was wholly useless in terms of providing encouragement or support to families that are on the spectrum. It's that he was completely inaccurate. The things that he said, the assumptions that he made about the outlook for children and families on the spectrum, about whether they are a burden or not, about whether they work or not, whether they'll ever play sports or not, all of it was really just something that could be said about those with the most severe diagnosis. But what he ignores is that the vast percentage of those who are on the autism spectrum become productive members of community if they are given proper supports. I want to give you some numbers on that. First of all, diagnosis and early intervention matters. So when you're looking at Head Start programs, when you're looking at community programs, when you're looking at what the special education dollars do when they're sent to the states, if this HHS secretary and the Trump administration was really looking to do something about autism to decrease the numbers, do you think they'd be cutting those funds? Doubtful. But we also find that 74% of children on the autism spectrum graduate high school with a diploma, which is, yes, less than the 86% of all students, but only slightly. Not the children are never gonna graduate, children are never gonna, okay? Only 21% of people with diabetes generally are employed. However, nearly 60% of people with autism in the United States are employed after receiving vocational rehabilitation services. These are the services provided state by state to children and young adults on the autism spectrum that help them to explore possible careers, find a job, and secure needed accommodations in the workplace. 60% are employable, Mr. Secretary. Become employed. Become contributors to community. Pay taxes, since that's what you seem to care about. That's not the story that the head of the government services, the man who's in charge of Medicare, Medicaid, the CDC, the NIH, the one responsible for overseeing all of our health needs and concerns, he obviously has no clue what the current numbers are or what this community is actually about. It seems like perhaps he's never met a child on the spectrum like my own son. For those of you who may be new to following me here on Don Lemon's channel, but have been following me on my channel, Monique Presley channel, or following me other places, you know that I do advocacy year round for those who are on the autism spectrum and their families. Fight for legislation, fight for protections in education, because when my son, who is now 19, was almost 2 years old, we realized that he was on the autism spectrum and got a diagnosis for him. Unlike many parents who have to deal with this, I had a legal education, and so did his dad. We had means, we had family support. We were able to wrap our son with the best possible care to give the best possible outcomes right away. We started right away. Many families are not that fortunate. And so when they hear things like this from this administration, they become desperate. They become dire. We were told lots of things at the beginning of our autism journey. He may never speak. He may never ride a bike. He may never be able to hold his breath underwater. He will likely not enjoy social interaction. All false. My son now reading on grade level, loving relationships with siblings, knows everybody's name at the school, enjoys conversing with his teachers, with his friends, participating in Best Buddies program, swimming laps in the pool. You really have to decide what report you're gonna believe. And I'm here to suggest to you, it better not be RFK Jr.'s, because he doesn't know what he's talking about, friends. So, what can you do? You can share the information that you've seen on the screen. You can support organizations that are actively fighting to defend the rights of children with special needs generally, and those on the autism spectrum specifically. You can be a friend. You can be a family member of support and community. When you see somebody who's struggling, function with understanding, knowing that they may be in a hard space right now, but they won't be there always. You can share this information with your friend group, with your family group. You can be that helpful person in your community who maybe is paying attention and looking out for things in a young toddler that a family can't see for themselves because they're not getting adequate pediatric care the way that every family deserves, but often is not available in communities. Another thing that is under the direction of the current HHS secretary and the Trump administration. We can stand in the gap for each other. I know that there are stories that are different from mine, that children, you meet one child on the spectrum and you've met one child on the autism spectrum. They are all unique humans. They are all different. They all have different projected outcomes and they'll all have different realities. But here's the thing that's for sure. They are all spectacular humans deserving of every possible chance of success. They are not a burden. They are a gift and an opportunity for us all to be inclusive in the way that we think about others and think about ourselves. That's all I have for you today. Thanks for being here. Please subscribe to my channel, Monique Presley Channel. Please like this video. Please share it. Until next time, next Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern, stay safe out there.
Thanks, everyone, for watching.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black, but I'm going to keep it brief. So I finally went to go see Sinners, and what was I talking about? I'm sorry. It was just two very large Michael B. Jordans on screen at the same time, and y'all might want to pull my notes up so I can stay focused. All right, now, as I'm sure you've heard, Sinners debuted with a 100% Rotten Tomato score, which is only ticked down to a 98% a week into its box office run. Critics and audiences alike are hailing it as one of the biggest and possibly the best movie of the year. And by the end of the opening weekend, the film had grossed over $63 million. And I get it. When I first seen the trailer and it had two big fine Michael B. Jordans, gave us a period piece setting and vampires, I was set immediately. That's all I needed. But it was also a race film. Yeah, very much that. And of course, moving goalposts for black creatives is expected at this point. These folks will denigrate, minimize, and otherwise ignore anything we make, especially if it challenges white supremacy. So alongside the praise, there are also a few comments about how the movie is doing well, but not as well as it needs to be. Is everybody okay? How on earth does a $60 million opening weekend for an original studio movie warrant any backtalk? Well, that's just because not everybody is going to like black people making a black-ass movie that brings everybody outside. Yeah, I gotta say, the movie theater that I went to was full of non-blacks, which really pleased my heart when I saw all of beauty and complexity they were exposed to in this film. Sinners explores real deal scary shit that was going on down the Mississippi Delta in the 1930s and 40s. It's not implied, it's not alluded to, it knocks you right over the head with a message. In steeping Sinners in the horror genre, Ryan is able to acutely align the realities of being black in the Jim Crow era to the fantastical creatures and nightmare scenarios that can scare the living daylights out of anybody watching across race. Ryan is able to ask what would you do in the situation while simultaneously exhibiting what black people had to do to survive in the Jim Crow South. Now, if you ask me what I would have done, I would have thrown Grace ass outside the moment she started acting sketchy. And Pearlene ass too, for that matter, for not wanting to eat the damn garlic. Pearlene ass that should have been home with her husband in the first place. But in that same vein, the movie sparked so many layered and complex conversations. Take Pearlene, for example. It was 1930s Mississippi. While she has been argued to represent lust of the seven deadly sins, she could have very well been married off as a young girl to an old, stankin', nasty, musty old man 3 to 4 times her age. We saw the complexity of passing at play with Mary. We saw, even if briefly, the juxtaposition of apparent racism in the South and covert racism in the the North. Hoodoo was even represented in a non-demonic way. Hello? White folks know they love to demonize African religious traditions, sharecropping, and chain gangs. Oh, did I say spoiler alert? Oops. Well, we're here now. And I have got to say, my favorite scene had to be the conjuring of ancestral and futuristic interpretations of music and movement, and not of just Black culture, but Asian cultures as well. Ryan Coogler did his big one. Hey, man, put me in the next movie. This film was a love letter to the Deep South and its people. It beautifully captures the wide open expanses of the Delta and fully embraces the beauty, creativity, sensuality, and complexity of Black folk just trying to survive. And again, he did it in a way that brought so many people to the table, masterfully intertwining history, relatable characters, fantasy, and more. They gave anybody watching an inroad to truly appreciate Black culture. And that's why the whole undermining thing is so annoying. We need to be channeling this energy into giving Wunmi Musaku her flowers. Or, hello, Mr. Miles Caton. Black people are amazing. And them folks who are up and down, the people don't want to see us in fantasy and stories like Sinners. And yet, here it is on track to become the highest grossing R-rated film to be released in April since 1993. And, quiet as his cap, Ryan took Warner Brothers to the cleaners. With his impressive resume, Mr. Coogler took the Sinners screenplay to Warner Brothers with a list of demands. A $90 million budget, control of the film's final cut, receiving a percentage of the initial box office gross, which somehow is not routine, and insisting on retaining ownership of the movie for 25 years. And on top of that, he filmed that whole bad boy on film, not digital, which is expensive as hell. But Warner Brothers agreed, and the industry at large was not really feeling it. And that, my friends, is a very important thing to consider in a time like this. Politically, Black people are up against a complete onslaught on their history and their voices. And as much as we have to keep our eyes on the prize in terms of policy, art has always been and will always be one of the most significant avenues to fight against oppressive tactics. It keeps your mind free so you can keep the rest of you free.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media.
Welcome home, y'all.
We're here for this week's mini pod, and I'll just tell you guys, I was just telling Angela a story, but I didn't get a chance to get her opinion on it, so we're going to talk about that on the mini pod. So I'll tell y'all the story now. So I saw a Black woman at the airport, and we just started making small talk. And she obviously does well for herself, you know, and we were both in the like priority line, and we're just chatting, and she starts talking about how challenging it's been in the private sector these days. And I was saying, yeah, there's been some really great writing contextualizing, you know, how challenging it is. And she says, again, y'all, this is a Black woman. She says, yeah, it's so frustrating. I just feel like people don't like when we make money. Like, they just get mad at people who work in corporate America who make money. And I am immediately offended at this entire sentiment. And thankfully, one of our other friends was there. I want to say who that is. I don't think she'll care. Joteka was there. Joteka Edie, who you guys know, leads Win with Black Women and is just a phenomenal person, a phenomenal singer, too, if you are lucky enough to hear her sing. And so I am immediately like, you know, ready to attack, you know. So I'm like, that's not true at all. People don't like when you make money on a system that's crushing them. I don't think people are just looking at you like, I'm mad that you make money. But Joteka came in very softly, but directly, and contextualized it a lot better than I did, because I immediately felt like, I don't like this Black woman because she sounds like them. And I feel like she moved like them. But what is a better way to deal? Because in my space, I'm like, I don't want to know you. You know, we're not the same. And I don't want to try to convince you. You know, because like you 50 something years old, you feel how you feel. But I just immediately I'm like, I don't like it. How do you think you would have handled it? What are your thoughts about all of it?
Sometimes I can be, I think, defensive and combative. And I think other times something is so mind blowing. I want to understand why. So I think I would have said, I mean, I like to believe I would have said, can you tell me what you're talking about? Like, tell me what you mean by they don't want you to make money.
Yeah.
Just to unpack what she could have meant. I think that we're in an era right now where that type of fundamental misunderstanding is deadly. And I think we're seeing that across the board. I think there is like the proletariat rising kind of vibes.
Yeah.
Right now. And I'm puzzled by what she means. especially when the proletariat rising is the reason why maybe she got her bonus last year mm-hmm. or the year before, because people saw her humanity and wanted to ensure that she was paid the same as everybody else. I think what isn't fair is the widening gap. The widening gap between incomes for folks who are at the, you know, entry-level jobs to the folks that sit in the C-suite. And I guess I would ask that sister, like, what do your parents do?
Yeah.
What did your grandparents do? You know, how would they feel about X, Y, Z? Really just trying to understand it. Now, she might come back and be like, well, I'm a fourth generation trust fund baby, or, you know, whatever.
She said after she caught the vibe, mm-hmm. it feels like she tried to change it a little. She's okay. like, well, I came from dirt to get this, which made me even more angry.
That's I'm what
like,
I was
then
saying.
What the fuck are you talking about yeah. then? Like, were you mad at people making money? You know, like, how did you feel when you came from this dirt, you say, and you saw all the people around you making money on this system of capitalism that does not always serve us?
You know, Tiff, I'm going to tell you, I think that I'll just acknowledge this. I think that all of us are wired differently. We're like, it's truly that we're defined by our own experiences. There are some people who come from dirt who are like, I never want to experience that again. And I'm going to claw mm-hmm. whatever and however, even if it means you. To stay in that, like, I'm going to sink my claws in this to make sure I never experience that again.
Yeah.
And we don't know who she's financially responsible for. Like, she might be feeling threatened in a way that's not rational. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it is. I don't know what her experience is at work. She might be getting reprimanded at work for being black.
She's going through all of this because in the DEI space, like mm-hmm. she's had to change her job title. Just all of this. And I just couldn't believe she said that. But I'll tell you, it's making me think of something else that we got into last week.
What?
So many people commented on this and we didn't even talk about
what?
It. Girl, Gail. When I started talking about Gail and you were like, I love you, Gail. That's Tiffany throwing shade.
Yeah.
A lot. And I just still feel this way. A lot of people are highly offended at her comments, which I am too.
What did she say?
When there was criticism around her going into space mm-hmm. And also her love for Jeff Bezos, mm-hmm. People had a problem with that. And so it was all this criticism, very loud voices. And so she was doing an interview with somebody and she looks at the camera and is like, have you been to space? And then black women lost their mind. They were like, what? And people were filming all these responses to her. Like, no, I haven't been to space. I'm paying two mortgages. Or I'm taking care of kids. Or I'm, you know, and it does feel
but
like.
Where was Meg Jameson in that moment to be like, actually, yes.
Well, but that was another thing, too, of calling herself an astronaut, you know, because she was like, I have so much trouble calling myself an astronaut. But I guess since I've been to space, it was like, right. You're not an astronaut.
You was a visitor.
Right. Right. And so it does feel like sometimes. That wealth can breed disconnect. I volunteer as tribute to get some wealth and show that I will not be disconnected.
Tiff said, if you get run her $1 million, she gonna sign a pledge that she gonna stay connected.
I really think I would give a lot of money away because it's hard for me. And to be honest with you, when you say when you come from nothing, part of me does feel that way, to be honest. I don't ever want to go back. I was born in Cleveland. Anytime I go to Cleveland, I could break out in hives. I'm sweating. Like, I can't stand it. I get the memories of the time that I spent there. I always want to get, I had a speaking engagement there. I could not wait to leave. No diss to Cleveland, of course, and the people who live there. I have family there. But I just, those times, I don't like it. The State of the People tour is kicking off this weekend in Atlanta. And it's not a space for me to go and learn. You know, it's a space. It's like I'm revisiting a space of when I didn't have. Sometimes I don't want to revisit that space. And I'm panicked all the time that I'm going to return. It is PTSD growing up without and black. Because I'm panicked all the time that at any point I'm going to be living that way again.
Yeah.
I always think, you'll appreciate this, having lived in D.C. I'm like, at some point, I feel like I'm going to wake up in a nightmare where I'm living out in Laurel on public assistance, you know, in a little 20-year-old vehicle that barely runs. Mm-hmm. And it is such a panic for me. So I am like that in some levels.
Yeah.
But I don't want my people in that space.
That's
I want
right.
to help my people as much as I can get out. And I feel so connected to my people who live like that. And I know how I felt having people come and talk and watching people on TV. I felt such a disconnect from those people.
But that's the thing, too. I think that we sometimes are under the assumption that wealth is the only disconnector.
Yes.
You know, working in politics can be a disconnector.
Sure.
Working in media can be a disconnector. I think that we all have maybe a collective obligation. And if we had a call to action from the podcast, maybe it's finding other ways to connect with people who you feel like you don't have anything in common with, who are saying stuff that get on your nerves.
Yeah.
For me, people that, you know, I normally don't spend a lot of time with. And I think that is why I am so excited about the tour, because I don't crave disconnection. I actually really crave connection and knowing how to best advocate for my folks and also how to connect with my folks. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be disconnected. I think that's the greatest insult. You know, sometimes I have it, sometimes I don't. You know, and it's not on purpose. I just, I'm like, either my patience is run thin, or I'm like, how could you think that? That's so dumb, or whatever it is. But I don't want to be that way. I want to be able to lean and live into grace. And I think that the way to do that is through conscious connection.
Yeah.
So
I'm excited.
I am not an astronaut. I do love Gail. I hate that she did that. But you know what? I did feel a little empathy for her. Right. When you were talking about, she was saying she loved Jeff Bezos. That's her friend, right? I guess. For me, I have some rich friends.
Jermaine struggled for years with dental issues before finally finding Nuvia. Listen to what he wanted most after his smile makeover.
I want to be able to smile at my wife.
And I don't want nobody talking about them.
But if
they're
you're
not trillionaires.
Yes. But if you're, I mean,
and all of my friends are rich. I do have some, and they have good hearts, and they do really good things.
Look, I'm her friend, and I ain't rich. So she,
I'm her friend, and I ain't rich.
Exactly. But I think if your friendship robs you of logic and facts, then it's hard to have a conversation about it.
Well, I am very illogical about y'all.
But I'm not logical. If somebody comes to you and they're like, you know, I didn't like what Tiffany said, and this is why, like, I don't expect you to be robbed of logic and facts, you know, moment you might say, well, just so you know, that's my girl. But I hear you. And thanks for sharing, you know,
I might, like, but I'm also going to be like, that don't sound like her. Let me find out what she meant.
But if it's something that you heard, something that you two disagree with, or you feel like, that I know Tiffany did this thing, and I think that thing is wrong.
Give me an example.
Well, I don't do anything wrong, and everything I say is right. So.
I don't know. This is true. She doesn't do anything wrong. Never.
I know. The when I didn't want to show the video to Trump supporters. And you wanted to show the video.
We disagree with that.
But if people are coming up to you like, she get on my nerves. Like, I wanted to see that. Where does she know?
I would be hot. I'd be like, no, she don't get on my nerves. You don't get to say that to me.
You
I'm telling you, I'm
that,
not logical.
You can say that, but you can say, I take your point.
No,
you know,
they cannot come to me and tell me that you get on their nerves.
Yeah, that's true.
They don't even know
comes,
you.
That's true.
No, I'm not ever going to be a receptacle for mess for my friends.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it. Even for people that are associates, I'm not doing it.
Well, then I would say that because that's true.
Because I want people to be that fiercely protective of me.
I was going to say, if somebody came to me like, Angela, get on my nerve, like that would be a challenge for me.
You would say, what you making up?
Okay, Angela's talking about the time that I almost got into a fight. We almost got into a fight
she was
with
not
somebody.
Get in a fight. I would have got into a fight with that man.
This man was disrespectful to Angela on the elevator, and I told her if I see him, I was gonna say something. But I'm saying,
and she did say something,
and I was ready to throw some knuckles.
You were better on. You were actually better on the.
Because I can't like act out the fight.
You practiced it. I was really nervous.
They didn't believe me, y'all. And I said, if I see him, I'm gonna say something.
Tiffany need to stay reading books because this is not her ministry.
No, it really isn't my ministry. But I'm willing to fight. I'm willing to fist fight for my friends. So I take your point, but I think. For a Jeff Bezos type friendship, if I come to you and say Jeff Bezos is on some bullshit, and if you're saying to me, that's my friend, and we have a disconnect here, you know?
And you could say that, but I want you to hear why I say that's my friend. And I tell you stuff all the time where you're like, meh, and I'm like, well, let's talk about it. I don't know. I just feel like I hate when people soundbite us. I want to know, like, the full context of what she was going into. And also, like, I'd love to hear the extent of their friendship. Like, how did they become friends? You know, what does it look like? What are your favorite things about this person? Because maybe there's a side of humanity we just don't see.
I don't really care, to be honest. Like, I think if, you know, this person is he's funding a person who's causing harm, he's aligned with people who are causing harm to the greater good, then I don't care what his favorite food is. I don't care how y'all met. I'm looking at you sideways because you are so connected to this person.
You know,
you have chosen this friendship over this wide community of people who upheld you, cheered for you. And it feels like a disconnect because now I'm saying, well, stay with your billionaire friends and stay on that spaceship because I don't know how much space we have for you in community anymore. After you flexed on everybody saying, have you been to space? Number one. And number two, I'm not there yet.
Okay.
But I'm saying if she cannot call out his role in the problem that we're facing here.
But I don't think that's what Gail does. Like, I don't think that...
That's a challenge, too.
Well, okay, but...
In a position of power, what is your point in ascending to this level, hosting a show, and it's not bravery if you don't have fear. Like, of course there's going to be a consequence. That's how you exercise bravery. And so if you are not brave enough to say, hey... You know, this is a problem. Or, hey, I'm not going to report this like it's okay. Or, hey, I'm not going to let you sit here and disrespect Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote this brilliant book, who deserves to have his point heard.
I hear that.
Then I got to question you.
I hear that. But also, we have friends in multiple spaces that make decisions about when they're going to challenge things and
That's
when they're
true.
Not.
That's
so
true.
I just am saying, like, I don't know. And for me, I would want the benefit of somebody asking me. And I can say that I have experienced her. We both do United Justice Coalition together. And otherwise, I wouldn't know Gail.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's one of those spaces where it does flatten privilege.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are people like Crystal, you know, who was arrested for trying to exercise her franchise just because she had a record. We have people like the mother of the man who died in Parchman.
Mm-hmm.
And folks like Gail who... will say, I'm reporting on this. I'm going to use my platform to share these stories. You know, like, and when asked, she's like, absolutely. So it's hard for me because I don't expect her to show up like me.
Mm-hmm.
I do expect her to show up. And I can say in that space, at least 9 times out of 10, maybe 10 out of 10, she's showing up.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean,
yeah, people are multidimensional.
I have not been to space.
I still have an issue.
I don't think I want to go on one of them ships neither, though. I want to go.
I'm not going on Jeff Bezos, nothing. My issue is the way this conversation started is about us and wealth,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how we can change when we have wealth and can we stay connected to community?
We have to.
I've seen a lot of people with money get disconnected from community.
That's
and
what
I was
saying.
Say
I don't think it's just
one.
Money, though. I think you could move out of your neighborhood and get disconnected. I think you could.
You get old and get disconnected. I said on the podcast this week, I don't know who 19 Keys is. I feel so disconnected from people.
But
I can't
name
there,
like,
the
there is something
song.
Even about our elders. You can't move around the way that you used to be able to move around and you get disconnected. So sometimes it's not even intentional.
Yeah.
It's you are a product of your circumstance.
Yeah.
So I do think, I like this, the idea of intentional, meaningful connection. I think that helps us live in grace, embody grace, and maybe patience with each other. And maybe it gives us space to confront somebody too if you know, what they're doing is off. But I think that my weakness is, man, I hate when I get misunderstood somewhere online or from some media clip or whatever. I'm like, well, what's behind that?
Well, I don't misunderstood. I mean, as you know, I'm I will listen and I'm a reader. She was not misunderstood. I mean,
but I'm saying maybe she doubled down in something that was nonsense in that moment, but that's not the totality of who she is. Like, I don't want people to judge me off of Snoop. Or you know what comes up all the time? There's a moment where me and Leonard were talking about Louis Farrakhan on a podcast. And I was frustrated at the time about what I was hearing him say that felt anti-Semitic. It was one clip. I don't think he's an anti-Semite.
I don't think so.
I don't. I actually summarily reject it when I hear it every time. But it came up and the minister actually ended up reaching out. Mm-hmm. He was like, you know, young sister, I just want to talk to you. And I was like, I hope you know that that's not what I think. Now people quote it and say that I called him dumb and like crazy stuff that I've never said. And it's frustrating because this is a man that I grew up looking up to.
Yeah.
When my dad went to the Million Man March, I got to stay home and watch the Million Man March today. Yeah. So I would never. You know?
Well, I think there the masses can do that. There are a lot of people out there. I am basing this on we're in the same industry, years of watching Gail, being in the same spaces with her. I feel like you and me together probably been in the same spaces with her. I've had conversations with Gail before. Based on everything that one of my friends is her executive producer. I won't say her name. She might have to disassociate from me now after I said this.
Well, now you just named her.
I know. But my point is, I'm not basing this on a clipped bite. I would never, you know, like I am fully aware of some things that she's done and said in their totality, and space just being the latest. I was disappointed, as you know, in how that Ta-Nehisi Coates interview went
down. I was too.
Yeah.
I was too.
So it's a collection of things, but I not to just pick on Gail. And I also defended Gail after she asked what I thought to be an inappropriate question of Lisa Leslie after Kobe's death. And people pounced on her and called her out of her name. I was on Joy Reid's show and defended her because I thought the question was out of pocket and not done in journalistic integrity. But people disrespecting her and calling her a bitch and like all these things, we don't have to do that. So I don't want to just pick on Gail, but I do think her remarks were incredibly tone deaf and very disrespectful to a lot of people who are going through a lot of challenges right now because of this administration. And she is publicly praising someone who was very much aligned with this administration and considers him a friend, considers his wife a friend. And just it felt disconnected and it felt disrespectful. And one of the chief reasons why Gail is who she is because of the support of Black women. And so when Black women are calling you out and tapping you on your shoulder, I think it's enough for you to listen and just check yourself.
Maybe she is.
I hope so. Yeah. Maybe she'll come out and say something about it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there is something about wealth and us. And I just wonder, you know, when they get wealth, it's different. When we get wealth, I think it comes with obligation and responsibility.
I agree.
Yeah.
We all know. Like, members of Congress, some of those members of Congress are making the most money they've ever made in their lives and taking care of a whole bunch of people. Yeah. And that is on the low end. But still, it would probably be the top 10% of income earners in the country.
Yeah, especially among Black folks.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, if you all know a way that we can do a social experiment and Angela and I can get wealth, let us know because we are willing to.
Tiffany wants to trade Forex.
What's Forex?
Some nonsense. My brother does that.
See, I'm disconnected. This could be some popular thing.
You should
thing
stay
that
disconnected
know about.
From that.
I don't know
in the name
anything
of
about
Jesus,
it.
Stay disconnected from that. Remember
I don't know attention? Anything about it. But what I appreciate about today,
I got bitcoins.
I have some.
Oh, you do?
Yeah,
I got some
years ago.
Years ago. Are you rich on that?
No.
Do you look on them?
I have somebody overlooking my
how
my
much
entire
you got
financial. $1,500.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's more
it's
than
with,
me.
I don't know if I can say the company, but
don't say
yeah,
it.
Yeah, do. I that's what I have now. I don't remember how much I put in. It wasn't a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I have $1,500 now.
$1,500.
So I think if I put in $1,500, how much would I have now? Had I put in $20,000, how much would I have now? You know, but
I put in $100.
How much you have now?
Let's look.
Yeah, while she's looking for that, pull it up because I want to know. While she's looking for that, what I will say I appreciate about this conversation is the challenge for people to extend grace.
I know, Mom. I'm really lucky you gave me a head start with Self.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a safety net back then. But with Self, you've been able to build your credit and savings each month.
And to make sure that you understand what someone's saying. And
I can't remember the app that I started doing. Is it called Bitcoin? Bitcoin.
We challenge you to make sure that you understand the totality of someone's statements, not in clipped Instagram.
Coinbase.
But just understand the full context of what someone is saying before posting.
I got a
and
new now phone is logged out.
Oh God, we don't know how much Angela made.
I'm gonna tell y'all next time.
Yeah, next. Oh, stay tuned to see how much wealth we've built in a week when we're back here. Anyway, you got anything else to say to the people before we go?
Yeah, I'm mad. I logged out my Coinbase. I was looking forward to reporting back if my $20 grew.
So they gotta tune in. It's just one of those 1980s to be continued.
You know, I'm not
I remember. But people don't know about that to be continued. Man. You know, now you get to binge watch 12 episodes. But in the 80s, when the show went off and it was to be continued, baby.
When they played that music?
Yes.
That would be a cold game.
You
when they
could not
them.
Wait. It's wait, like, woo, Family Ties is a two-parter. I know what I'm doing with my
Sha-la-la.
Time.
Sha-la-la.
Well, we old. Anyway. Thanks for tuning in to
what
this mini-pod, guys.
Baby?
Without love. Sha-la-la-la.
And there ain't no nothing we can't love each other.
What do we do, baby?
Oh, I got in my Bitcoin.
Okay. This ain't the to be continued then. What's your Bitcoin?
Okay. Here you go.
That's a drum
device
roll.
Not recognized.
Okay.
It's a two-parter.
All right. Never mind. To be continued. Sha-la-la-la.
Sha-la-la-la. That's how we should end the episode now. Forget welcome home. Sha-la-la-la.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
We didn't talk about Carmelo Anthony and what happened because I'm waiting a beat. Like there's some stories going on that I want to wait to see all of the information. It, and people are using these moments to divide and to build platforms because this is the world that we're in. Everyone, as Dr. Suri said, wants to jump in front of a camera, jump in front of these stories so they can gain influencer, you know, the numbers so that they can make money. But this is not the time. So they had a White Lives Matter rally this weekend to, you know, because they're saying, you know, this country is, you know, under siege by these black criminals and white people are in jeopardy. And Austin Metcalf was killed by a raging, violent black boy who now we know Carmelo Anthony is nothing that they said he was. And what's even worse, Omi, is that Austin Metcalf's dad is not with it. So A black man showed up to the rally with Austin Metcalf's dad on the phone. With the cameras, you know, because they had the cameras and everything.
Yeah,
I'm gonna play the clip. You need to hear this. Okay. Play the clip, Smith. Metcalf's dad. This is wild. So the first voice you hear, I think, is gonna be a black man confronting the guy that started the White Lives Matter rally. Okay, so he's confronting him. Play it, Smith.
Fathers who are not dealing with grief. You've talked for an hour. So if you want to address, I can give you after I give this message. The bottom line is this: you have a father that's out of respect asking you not to put his son's face in a place. How do you say you're going to represent people when you can't respect the will of the people?
His father has asked.
Hey, let me respond, guys. There's too much peanut gallery.
That's not what his father said. His father did not say that.
Can we please let me respond?
So
you believe. Hey, you believe.
I'm
having a conversation between you and I.
That's just what that is.
Listen to this.
Yeah.
Austin Metcalf is no longer Austin Metcalf. He is a symbol. He is a symbol of young white people being predatorized and victimized every single day, living in fear. He is living in fear. Our people in this country are living in fear. Austin Metcalf is
Jeff,
no longer
Jeff,
just
Jeff,
a son.
Jeff, hold on, Jeff. Do me one favor, because there seems to be an issue that you're okay with Austin's name being plastered with this particular move. Now, I've already addressed that. So now I want you to say one more time.
Pause it. So this black man got the phone. You just heard the voice of this guy's name is Jake Lang. He is a January 6th person. He stormed the cat. He's an insurrectionist, horrible human being. Started a rally using Austin Metcalf as the avatar for white people being under, being oppressed by black people and having their lives threatened. And they're using this young man's death as a rallying cry to get white folk into the streets, right? They're looking for any way in. And this black man has Austin's dad on the phone. They don't know this. So as he's confronting them, saying, stop doing this, the father doesn't want it, they were like, you don't know what you're talking about. You hear him say, Jeff, can you tell them, play it, Smith.
Do you agree with your son's name and face being attached to this movement?
Hey, Jeff Metcalf, this is Jake Lang here. I wanted to talk to you and not be led into a question. This is an illegal argument. It's called leading.
Do you agree with your son?
Can I have a conversation with you?
No, because you could have called him before that. You could have called him out of respect.
I've been reaching out. I'm one of the biggest figures in America. Nobody's ever.
I've given you a message. I've given you your message, and here's the response.
Family members, everybody I can find.
I've given you your message, and here's the response.
You're not giving my message.
This guy said,
"Yo, your message."
What he said was this. What he said was this. He said that you, as a father, should be on the bus with him, delivering the message that he's delivering. Unfortunately, he's not a father, and the gentleman with us is not a father. Maybe they don't understand what love is. But at the end of the day, I've given your message, and they thought that it wasn't your message.
Let me have 1 minute of my message to Jeff Metcalf.
Call him.
Okay, what's his number?
We will, but he's on the phone right now.
So, Jeff, do you?
Huh? This is not a good faith discussion.
Okay, hold on. Here's Jeff. Hold on. So, Jeff, go ahead. Jake?
Hey, Jeff, it's Jake Lang here.
Yes, sir. What can I do for you?
Jeff, first of all, my entire heart rests in your hands. I would be in my position, not even as somebody even knew your son, but somebody that shares the same understanding. I grew up as a 17-year-old young white man, too, and I grew up in fear of my life around black people because they were killing and robbing people around me all the time. And I don't understand, as I was a father, you could sit idly by and not condemn the culture that killed your son. There is an epidemic problem in this country, and your voice could be one of the loudest voices in this country, but you've chosen to recoil out of fear and continue the suppression. Why will you not stand with me and with the rest of the people? We're not calling for racial divide. We're not calling for hatred. We're saying 350,000 attacks on white people by black people a year in this country is wrong. Why can't you stand that and say with that? Maybe you can. Would you be willing to stand by me in a press conference or in an individual interview and talk about this issue that is larger than Austin at this point? God rest the beautiful young man's soul that would have been one of our strongest voices if he was still alive today.
Are you done?
Yes, I am, sir.
Are you done?
Okay, my turn to speak. You are part of the fucking problem, my friend. You're trying to create more race divide than bridging the gap. I do not condone anything you do. You do not have any fucking...
That's called white guilt.
No, let it talk.
My son, let me finish. I gave you your time. You take my son's face off your website. I am not associated with you.
You're creating more Austin Metcalfs with your weakness, sir.
All right, let's take it down because it's hard to hear him. But he said, you're the effing problem. Take my son's face off your website. I don't want to have anything to do with you. And this is the way we move forward. All of the lies that this cretin is putting out and then building a movement around this and then having a black man stand behind him, agreeing with him. So this is the weird thing, too, because anti-blackness shows up in all bodies. But it's just for commerce sake and it's just for attention that this guy is doing it. Austin Metcalf's dad said, no, you are the problem. You will not use my son to continue to divide. And that a black man was able to deliver this message tells me more about this story than meets the eye. And it's not the media is not really reporting that somehow the Metcalfs are not, you know, these bastions of white supremacy and white nationalism. But Jeff Metcalf is saying something right now. And he delivered the message to a black man, which is saying something as well. My son is not to be used as an avatar for your racism. And this is the way forward. And we have to call on everyone, you know, like we had Rachel Bitticoffer on. It's not enough to just, you know, be out here. You have to be vigilant in gathering up your folk and saying this is zero tolerance. You know, around this, we're going to have cookouts and family reunions. You know, your racist pawpaw should be confronted. This is the time. Either that or you're with it.
100%. And everything he's saying is just bullshit because he grew up in Narrowsburg, New York. Then he moved to Newburgh, New York. Neither one of these are majority black. Narrowsburg is 85% black. Newburgh is 52% black. You didn't grow up around nobody killing nobody, sir. Okay, first one, if you were, it was white on white. So wherever you live in that, whatever psychotic break you're having, you need to deal with that. And that's the thing, is like this narrative of like calling this man weak, the caucasity of you to decide, I'm going to take this person's child and make that without their consent, without talking to them, I'm going to take their dead son. And I'm saying it that harsh because that's how harsh it should be heard. And say, oh, no, he's the face of this movement. Because I was just like him. What? This man, that is wild to me. That's wild.
And he's not sick. There's nothing wrong. Like, this is on purpose. I mean, this is, maybe it is a sickness. Maybe it is.
Experience Karen Hunter in a completely different way. Karen Hunter is awesome. The podcast.
If you like me on SiriusXM Urban View Channel 126, you're going to love me.
And Karen Hunter is awesome.
Hey, this is Karen Hunter, host of the Karen Hunter Show on SiriusXM's Urban View. Karen Hunter is Awesome is an actual podcast to bring heat and energy and knowledge and power. A 1-2 punch that I don't think you get anyplace else.
Tell the truth.
So check out the podcast wherever you get your podcast. You will not be disappointed.
Now, in 1962, James Baldwin published in the New York Times Book Review an essay entitled As Much Truth as One Can Bear. There he wrote, quote, "The effort to become a great novelist simply involves attempting to tell as much of the truth as one can bear, and then a little more. We must, as Baldwin put it, quote, deal with what words hide and what they reveal." End quote. This is all the more important in a country like our own, where our stories obscure the horrors of what we've done and ensure our sense of innocence and inherent goodness. And here I'm speaking as an American, of course. Telling the truth here in the United States, especially in dark times like our own, requires a kind of courage and commitment to shatter national illusions that offer safety and comfort. Requires a kind of risk associated with the charismatic madmen that Faber talked about, yes? It involves risking it all in moments like these in order to release us into new ways of being together. And this will entail at times a withering criticism of the past that haunts and constrains, a scathing critique of our self-conception, a critique of who we are, how we became who we are, in order to release us into a different kind of future, a pedagogical practice with a prophetic inflection. Baldwin insisted that we ask the hard question, how shall we put ourselves in touch with reality? He understood the pernicious effects of the lie on America's character, that the lie involved what we tell ourselves, for example, about black and white people in this country, that white people ought to be valued more than others. And we witness the monstrous consequences of what follows from this view in terms of our dispositions and practices, and we see it in the haunting spectacles of black grief and death. And in this moment of crisis today, we see in real time the reassertion of the lie. We see it not just in Trumpist affirmations of American virtue, but in the attacks on immigration, in the debates around history, and in the attack on so-called critical race theory, in the attack on women's ability to choose, in that assault on the second reconstruction of the mid-20th century, in the assault on democracy itself. In the United States, we prefer our lies straight, no chaser. What does it mean to be prophetic in this moment? What does it mean to offer a prophetic stance, a prophetic witness in this moment, not to look for some prophet from on high, not to look for some hero to resolve the issue, not to outsource our responsibility to someone else? What does it mean for each of us to take on the prophetic role in a moment when lies have overwhelmed so much of our idea of the good? We have to admit that the trouble is deeper than we wish to think, because the trouble is in us. Remember I said earlier that we are the serpents in the garden? As a nation, America stands on a knife's edge. The background conditions that make our democracy possible have cracked wide open. We have to dare to be otherwise, to be prophetic close to the ground. We must risk everything to put the sin of racism and greed and selfishness behind us and figure out how to be together differently. And that will be hard work. We have to tell the truth as we see it, and then a little bit more, uproot the practices that the color of one's skin The practice that the color of one's skin determines one's value. Challenge the world that has been made in that image. Enact a way of being together, a way that emerges organically from the rich diversity that gives this country life. In as much truth as one can bear, Baldwin wrote, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced, end quote. Such powerful words for us in the UN, in the United States, and I believe for you too. We cannot stick our heads in the sand this time. We cannot tinker around the edges. We must shake loose from the shibboleths of the past and their gods. We must become the prophets. No matter what has been done, no matter the death that shadows our steps, we cannot turn away from our responsibility. We have to imagine a new world. We have to imagine a world in which everyone can actualize their talents and capacities, can become who they imagine themselves to be. We cannot turn away from our responsibility. As Baldwin put it in his novel, Just Above My Head, quote, responsibility isn't lost, it's abdicated. And if one refuses abdication, one begins again. No more, right? If one refuses abdication, one begins again. Baldwin says, do your first works over. That's why we have to always return to the past, because the present is in dire need of an account of itself, right? We have to tell ourselves a different story. We have to, what? Find resources to imagine the possible in light of the actual, which is an all-out or involves in part an all-out assault on our imaginations. Huh? No more prophets descending from mountaintops with the law in hand. No more prophets descending from mountaintops. No more prophets speaking truths that aren't revisable. No more prophets telling us to lay down our burdens and to follow them. Instead, you and I, ordinary people, must strike the blow for freedom in the face of a world that insists that we all become like Saxon stomachs, to use Emerson's phrase. But if this is to be so, as William Faulkner suggested, we must not forget the problems of the human heart. Remember my worry, my ambivalence around a common faith, that Dewey's not attentive enough to the cry for help, to the vulnerability, to the wounds and brokenness of everyday ordinary folk. We mustn't forget the fears that drive us to idols. The fear and the desire for the comfort or the illusion of safety that send us barreling towards the comfort, the security of prophets and heroes, right? If we forget that, if we do, our griefs, quote, as Faulkner wrote, our griefs grieve on no universal bones, leaving no scars. Our imaginations become surfaced and barren. We write, quote, not of the heart, but of the glands, end quote. We mustn't forget the problems of the human heart. Each of us is called to bear witness and to imagine a new humanity close to the ground. If it's close to the ground, it's going to have to grapple with the messiness of who we are. We're all broken, wounded in some sort of way. We have to become dream warriors. Dream warriors. Dream prophets. To risk everything right now in this moment to make the world new. We're called, each of us, I think, to be that inexhaustible voice, to exhibit the spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance, and with the power, the prophetic power, the moral imagination, to call forth a new way of being human in this world.
Mayor Ed Gainey making several stops throughout the city today to put on display the work he says his administration has been doing to deliver affordable housing units. But his Democratic primary opponent, Cory O'Connor, questioning the data behind the number of affordable housing units. O'Connor says he asked to tour those units alongside the mayor today, but later declined.
When I asked for that, it's now all of a sudden changed to, well, we'll show you some that are preserved. We'll show you some that have some funding that might be under construction. You know, that's not being honest. You told the public that you had 1,600 new units, and I said I wanted to see 1,600 new units.
Mayor Ed Gainey has said his administration has delivered 1,600 affordable housing units during his time in office. But Cory O'Connor raising concerns about the language used when breaking down the numbers. Gainey clarifying while on that walking tour today that the 1,600 units delivered is a mix of units, including preserved, which are affordable housing units already in existence that his administration has invested in to maintain their affordability, as well as new construction, either completed or in progress.
Deliver secured, preserving them, and new construction. Those are the things that make up delivered, and that's what we've done. We're showing you right now, so just, I don't know what else to say but to show you.
Mayor Gainey ending that walking tour here at the Mosaic Apartments in Oakland, which when complete will offer 48 units of LGBTQ plus and senior friendly affordable housing. Reporting in Oakland, Kaylee Gunderson, Pittsburgh's Action News.
Everyone has a community, a neighborhood, school, place of worship, or other chosen groups. Communities can provide support when you need it, including helping your kids avoid underage drinking and other substance use. Learn more at talktheyhearyou.samhsa.gov.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, WRCT.org. Mr. Warren Wolf doing Christian McBride tune. And the name of the tune is called The Wizard of Monterra. So we hope you enjoyed that one. Jazz Corner.